Recorded live in the Phantasmo Lounge, high atop the Jackson Roykirk building in beautiful downtown Chesapeake, it's Phantasmo After Dark with your host, Rob Floyd, and Commander Tony Mercer. Our topic tonight, Star Trek, the motion picture.
At ease, human Floyd.
Thank you, sir. The much maligned Star Trek, the motion picture.
Indeed.
And we're going to determine whether that is justified or not tonight. But hey, a few weeks ago, real quick, I was at the Williamsburg Film Festival, and it was pretty cool. There were some cool guests. The coolest was Dick Warlock, who was Michael Myers in Halloween 2. And if you weren't there, you missed a really cool time. We showed Halloween 2, did a Q&A with him, and you can probably, I think they have that on, oh, what's that website? These guys were there, they're going to kill me. I'll put it on the Facebook page. It's a really cool website, Halloween something, and I'm ashamed that I can't remember it. But they were cool, and I think they filmed the whole thing, and it's on there. So I'll put that on
Now, what we should do is just look up the website, then say it correctly, and then cut out all that business where you couldn't remember. But that takes work, and I'm too lazy, so we're just going to keep on going.
This is the human element of it.
The human adventure is just beginning.
That's right. That's right. So anyway, I guess we do need to mention that Leonard Nimoy did pass a couple weeks ago, and this is our tribute episode to that. And you know, what more do you say that people haven't already said? Icon, been around since our childhood and before, and he's gone. So I just hope Shatner is keeping up on those checkups.
Multivitamins.
That's right. So, and also, if this comes out before April 3rd, April 3rd is Phantasmo Cult Cinema Explosion's 10th anniversary. 10 years of bringing you the best and the worst cult films to the big screen at the lovely Chesapeake Central Library in beautiful downtown Chesapeake at 298 Cedar Road. Check out the Facebook page for Phantasmo, and we'll have all the info. We're going back to the very first Phantasmo and showing the two movies we showed then, Buckaroo Banzai and Logan's Run. And it's going to be cool. We're going to do what we always do with door prizes, and there's drinks and snacks, and it's all 100% free. So join us, won't you?
You should have Jim Skype in for the evening.
We thought about that. If we can make it work, we might. I don't know. Okay. Then again, we might not. I mean, screw him.
Screw him anyway. Who cares?
Screw you, Blanton. You left us. So, onward. Star Trek, the motion picture.
Okay. So whether or not this hits the internet before, what was it, the 3rd that you said?
Yes.
It's entirely dependent on how egregious the pauses are, so just keep on, keep on talking.
Keep talking.
Says the king of pauses.
Well, that's
me.
All right.
No hypocrites here. I'm keeping it real.
So where are we going to start on this? Most people, typically it seems like the general thought on Star Trek the Motion Picture is it is not a very good movie. But we have talked about this before, and we each disagree that it is a pretty good movie.
Well, yeah. Well, first of all, I love this movie very much. I mean, yeah. let's just have out with it. Once I get to talking, if we're going to say anything of substance, it'll be apparent pretty quickly that I really like it. You know, we are both lifelong Star Trek enthusiasts. Yes.
Oh yeah.
Folks who enjoy the Star Trek.
Yes.
From the days when we were young and it was you know, in syndication and airing on television every evening.
Yeah.
And you would watch it. It was just
Before Star Wars, we had, you know, Star Trek in our living rooms.
Yeah. And it was ubiquitous to the point where, you know, I didn't really know anybody that didn't watch it. You know, whether or not you were a quote-unquote fan just comes down to how much thought you gave it, you know, and how long you stuck with it and to what extent you identified with it over time. But, yeah, I mean, the motion picture is divisive. I personally have found that the whole even number rule, you know, the idea that you know, every even numbered Star Trek movie is good.
Yeah.
So, you know, motion picture bad. Khan good, Search for Spock bad, Voyage Home good. Personally, I find that to be utterly disagreeable, if not complete errant nonsense.
Yeah,
and if matters of taste can be errant nonsense anyway.
Yeah,
and
well, they can.
And I also have found in my experience that a lot of real hardcore Star Trek fans don't go by that. That's sort of the lame, for lack of a better way to put it, that's sort of the layman's perspective.
Yeah,
that's sort of the pop culture idea of what Star Trek is or what the Star Trek movies are
like,
want
to sound
in
hip.
A very general sense, as yeah. opposed to the fandom's take on it or whatever. Because I completely disagree with it. You know, I think of the first four movies, I find Voyage Home to be the least of them. You know,
yeah.
It was very commercial. You know, it was commercially and critically popular.
Yeah.
And, you know, so be it. But it's the least worth discussion.
Yeah.
In my mind, you know,
because there's no stars and there's no trekking.
Yeah.
I mean, it's you know, Earthbound and yeah. in the past, yeah. and you know, it's technically it should have been a half hour episode.
Yeah.
I mean, come on. But it's weird how that one does get a lot of love and a lot of
That was one of the better Star Trek movies. Well, I find, again, most people that I know that really are really into Star Trek and really care about it don't like that one very much. The Voyage Home, Star Trek IV, is to some extent the Star Trek movie for people who don't actually like or care about Star Trek,
yeah.
which is really, and you can sort of politicize that if you want and say, oh, well, you know, it kind of makes fun of itself and that's what everybody wanted to see or whatever, but I don't want to go down that road. I would just say that you don't have to appreciate, you know, the core of Star Trek and what it is and all the things that can kind of go along with that and however you want to characterize that. You don't really have to care about Star Trek to find The Voyage Home entertaining. And that's no bad thing. Entertainment value is good,
yeah.
but it just isn't interesting.
Well, you know, and it wasn't as entertaining to me.
Oh, not at all.
as the other movies
yeah,
because
yeah.
it didn't take place in space. There were
yeah.
no starships, you know.
Yeah.
There was none of the conventions that go along with a Star Trek show or
yeah.
movie. It just had the characters. It had the faces. That was it. It had nothing else. You got the Klingon ship they're in at the beginning and at the end, but the rest of it, you know, they're walking around Los Angeles, and
yeah.
who the hell wants to go to Los Angeles? I mean,
yeah. Well, you know, but I think the beyond the very general, you know, critical reception, box office reception, general pop culture perception aspect of it, the discussion amongst fans as far as the movies and particularly the original cast movies are concerned tends to get into, you know, once you get past just was it entertaining or not, it tends to get into what was best representative of what Star Trek is meant to be, quote unquote, about.
Yeah.
Of course, what you'll find often is that people have differing ideas
of
what it's meant to be about in the first place.
Yeah.
You know, I think there is definitely a sort of core philosophy, if you will,
mm-hmm.
of Star Trek that can be spoken to. But oftentimes the debate is about, you know, is the motion picture truly representative of the characters? Is the motion picture truly representative of Gene's vision? And you know, any number of other points that you could get into with that.
Yeah.
But those aspects and others are highly debatable.
Mm-hmm.
What I personally like about it is that it is the most cinematically fulfilling and the most cinematically fascinating of the Star Trek movies.
Yeah.
Now, if you want to talk about what's the best representation of the characters and what appeals to me emotionally as someone who is invested in this fictional world and these fictional characters, well, clearly the winner there is Wrath of Khan.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But the motion picture is special. It's special it would be special if it was a singular entity and there had been no Star Trek movies beyond it for me personally.
Oh, yeah.
But it's made all the more special in that there have been many other Star Trek movies and the motion picture remains unique. And you can, and the cynical person who doesn't like it would say it's because it wasn't any good. Nobody wanted to repeat that mistake and nobody liked the motion picture. But, you know, what we'll get into as we actually get into the meat of this discussion, at least what I'll get into, is what I, you know, why I think it is good, what I do appreciate about it, and why its uniqueness is a positive and beautiful thing. Mm-hmm.
And before we get into that,
yeah, jump to the end before we start, right? Yeah.
One thing I noticed when watching, I don't know, the first three or four, not long ago, well, maybe a year ago now, on Blu-ray, besides the gorgeous transfers, is how uneven they are from movie to movie, as far as the look. The pacing, the design of the films, especially three, stood out until they get on the ship and get gone. The stuff on Earth and everything, some of the set and the costumes for the other characters and stuff looks like it was designed by the people who did Buck Rogers.
Yeah, no, that's very true.
Which is it just doesn't look like Star Trek.
No.
And, you know, you go from the motion picture to Wrath of Khan, and they're, they're two different movies.
Visually, each of those represents a radical redesign of the Star Trek aesthetic from the show, you know.
Yeah. But it's just like, it's almost like a reboot each time, but it's not, you know, on the overall design and look of the universe they're in.
Well, I would say, that
you don't notice it as much until you watch them close together.
Yeah, I would say that once you get past, so the first two are definitely radically different. They just get kind of shabbier after that, you know.
Yeah.
Was that because we know there were, if I remember correctly, anyway, sort of consecutive budget cuts from movie to movie.
Which makes no sense.
And each of them was made cheaper and cheaper. And then you get into, you know, so three and four are both directed by Leonard Nimoy and five is directed by Shatner.
Yeah.
So now you're in a position, and, you know, the trouble, of course, which I realized at the beginning when you said that the episode would be a dedicated to or a tribute to Leonard Nimoy, that was, off the cuff and inspired by a sincere desire to pay homage to Leonard, who we both look up to and like very much. But that does make it kind of difficult to get. It'll be a little prickly if I want to try to get into him as a director.
A tribute to him as a performer and a person.
Right.
How about that?
So
now with that disclaimer.
Yeah.
Go for
it. However, with that said, there are a lot of things sort of behind the scenes that went on in which I think Leonard was a very and I say Leonard as if I know him because, you know.
You didn't call him Len.
No.
So it's okay to call him
Leonard. Because that's how we feel about this iconic performer who has been with us, you know, as long as we can remember. Anyhow, so there are a lot of things that went on behind the scenes that show how Leonard was a very positive influence in sort of the evolution of the Star Trek movies and Star Trek in general over time. I think that's definitely true. But you could argue that the situation you find yourself in, you know, 3, 4, and 5 is one where the stars are now getting big for their britches and demanding that they want to direct. And, you know, in order to keep the series going, the studio just kind of lets them do it. But maybe they weren't the best choices to pull off anything particularly visionary in the aesthetic terms of that we're talking about as far as the design and the cinematic element of those pictures, you know. Now, all that said, I don't think it's deniable that Search for Spock is a shabbier looking production than The Wrath of Khan, and I don't think it's really all that well. Let me retract that a little bit. I would certainly not hold it up as a better movie in really any respect than The Wrath of Khan or as good as.
Yeah.
But it certainly has some great stuff
Well, it's got its moments.
Yeah, it's got some great stuff in it. And I think carrying sort of the thematic and emotional weight from it carries through on the thematic and emotional weight of Khan pretty well.
Yeah.
It's maybe not consistent, but there's enough great moments in it that I think it's definitely worthwhile.
Oh yeah.
And the voyage home, of course, everything gets silly, and you know, the less said about that, the better for
yeah,
me.
Yeah, and we shall speak no more of that in this podcast.
And then you get to, we still haven't really talked about the motion picture yet, but
well, we're gonna knock this out
screw
away
it.
Real quick.
Yeah, we'll do this anyway. Then you get to the Final Frontier. I'm leaving that Star Trek 5.
And I was going to leave it there, too.
I'm leaving it there to see what you're going to say.
Uhura fan dance. That's all I'm saying.
That's all he's got to say.
All I got on that one.
Yeah. So I would say I have often characterized, and I don't know if this is something I just came up with my own or if somebody else said it and I just picked up on it. I don't really remember. But I have often characterized Star Trek V as a third season episode.
Yeah. If you read, Shatner's Movie Memories book,
yeah,
he was constantly getting hit over the course of that with budget cuts as the movie was going on.
Yeah.
Because the ending was storyboarded and scripted a lot different than it actually did, a lot bigger a production.
Well, the whole story of its production is one of compromises from what he originally had in mind. But I'll be the first to say that having read some of what he actually originally had in mind, I don't know that that would have been that great either.
I'm not saying it would have been better. I'm just saying it was more to it. But as we have said before, Shatner should not direct himself.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's true. But what I was saying about it being a third season episode, what I mean by that is, you know, there's a lot of third season episodes that I like. And there's a lot of good ones, I think, but the third season, unfortunately, is a situation where even in the really good episodes, there's some things you're going to have to forgive it.
Oh, yeah. Well, any show on its last season where they know that's it, you know, the production suffers. And you do get some gems, like you say, but overall you get some lesser... there's not enough money to do, you know, a top shelf every episode. So you get, you know, Spock's brain.
Yeah. And well, it's definitely not a Spock's brain.
And wasn't the OK Corral, wasn't that a third season episode?
Yeah.
So, you know, the minimalist sets and all that stuff.
It's definitely not a...
Batman.
it's definitely not a Spock's brain. You know, Spock's brain is the exception that proves the rule where Star Trek is concerned. But, in quality, I should say.
Yes.
But Spock's brain is probably the only Star Trek episode that really has no value and that I wouldn't try to defend. But that's not true. Most of the third season episodes, that's not true. Most of them have at least a little nugget of something interesting and cool in them. And you just kind of have to forgive an awful lot of stuff that doesn't work. And I would say that about Star Trek V. It's got some really interesting ideas in it and some things that do kind of work. But it's also shabby, and it's got some really howlingly poor ideas and things that don't come off. But I'll take it over Star Trek IV any day of the week, because it's a sincere if failed attempt to do something interesting and something that's genuinely sort of within the Star Trek mind frame.
Yeah, I'll give you that. Yeah,
whereas IV is not. So
yeah, and it takes place on Starship in space and not on Earth in the past.
Yeah. Six I really like a lot. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Not perfect.
No. But it's pretty damn good.
It's pretty damn good. It's a very dignified end.
Yes.
For that series.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, and it's a great, I mean, and the last scene is the greatest end. Yeah. You know.
But, you know, something that we've talked about before, and we still haven't talked about the motion picture yet, but
we'll get there
on the subject of the original cast movies.
Yeah.
You know, I look back at those now and, I think about how lucky we are that we got to have and, you know, be around for in the first run, this series of, science fiction adventure movies about the exploits and personal travails of several middle-aged and elderly people.
Of adults.
You know what I mean?
And not teenagers.
It's like, can you imagine somebody trying to propose a sci-fi adventure series populated entirely by people in their 50s and 60s now?
It would be done tongue-in-cheek and played for laughs is how it would be done. Because nobody, you know, I don't know. I don't know if they get it or they place any value on it or, you know, what you would say. But it's just not the way things are these days. Everything is to the youngest or the youngest looking people for the cast of just about anything. And it's kind of boring. It's getting to where it's overdone and it's everything. You know, even in some of these crime shows where they're supposed to be spies or cops, it looks like they just got into college. You know, they just got out of high school. And I can't buy these people into parts. I'm just, you know, this doesn't look right. But you're right. I mean, you've got these, you know, you believe the characters because they look like seasoned veterans, like professionals that have been doing this a long time.
By the time you get towards the end, though, I mean, we're beyond seasoned professional and we're into folks that you can now qualify as elderly.
Well, they're in the twilight of their career.
Right. But that's what's great about it. And you know, I'm not necessarily saying this was by design, that there was a pitch, let's have elderly folks starring in these sci-fi adventure type movies. I realize that it came about sort of through a unique set of circumstances with the show and the time it took to get the movies launched after the show and the movement of fandom behind the show and all these things that kind of came together to make it happen. But whatever the circumstances, what's great about it is not only that we had it, but that the content of the films themselves addresses, you know, the advancement of time.
Oh, yeah.
And the deterioration of age and, you know, the reflection on life and dealing with death. And all these things are actually part of the thematic makeup of the films. It engages with the fact that these are older people in the twilight years and all that kind of thing, you know. And it relies on that for, you know, and then, of course, in the relationships between them, which at this point are at least somewhat informed by, you know, the age and the time that they spent together. And so the fact, just not simply the fact of their age, the point that I'm making is this, not simply the fact of their age, but that the films themselves are engaging textually with that is what makes them very special to me. And the older I get, the more I can appreciate how well lucky we are to have it, because there's nothing like it now.
Just as you were
saying. I mean, the cast, the you know, proxy cast in the Abrams Star Trek reboot movies, both in every way that actually matters, each one of them is a child.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean, I realize that they're all adult actors, you know, chronologically speaking and all that, but they look like children, they behave like children.
Mm-hmm.
The you know, overriding mentality of both the characters and the drivers in their story are very childish.
Yeah.
You know, childish humor, childish logic, childish science dominates those movies.
Yeah, let's put the starship on the ground and launch it into space.
You know, and
That
is how things are now, for better or worse. If you enjoy it, great. You know, hey, good on you. But for me, I celebrate, you know, a brief number of years where what we got, the good and the bad, in those original cast Star Trek films was a possible. You know?
Well, you know, and two, when they first came out, we were young. I mean, we were kids when those movies first came out. And, you know, the first three or four. And they dealt with those themes you're talking about aging and, you know, having their career and their long history and still doing it, and their aging and getting older is part of the story, like you said. It didn't bother us. I mean, it didn't. People still went to see the movies. Young people still enjoyed the movies. There was, because that was Kirk and Spock, and you know, those were those characters. Right. They're older, but so what? They're still there doing their job,
right?
And nobody said anything. It wasn't a big deal. As far as, you know, oh, well, they're old. You know, we need the younger people in there. No, that was them.
Yeah. Well, yeah, exactly. You know, and again, that's sort of circumstantial to some extent. It's these were the folks that were on TV.
Right? Yeah.
So you can relate to them on that. But, you know, and as a kid, you watch this stuff, and these are the characters from TV, and you're watching what's going on with them now, and you know it emotionally resonates with you because of their relationships and you know your pre-established relationship as if you were with them.
Yeah.
And then, but then, you know, Wrath of Khan is the best example of this. I feel like I as I said, I get older and I appreciate them more. They kind of grow up with you.
Yeah.
You know, you can't truly appreciate everything that's going on in that movie until you've gotten a little older, until you've gotten some experience.
Oh,
until
yeah.
You know, have some regrets and some reflections to make, and you've expressed, especially if you've, you know, experienced some loss. I mean, it just kind of deepens with all that, you know. Thanks, Nick Meyer, but well done. But it was well done.
Yeah, like, it was extremely well done.
Especially if you read up on, you know, how that all came together and just how quickly Meyer had to kind of crank out a script and get ready to direct that thing, and sort of the history of its production is very interesting. By the way, two resources to follow up on this discussion. If you're interested, if you haven't read this stuff before, there's plenty that's been written about, you know, the history of the Star Trek movies, but for material that is both entertaining and informative, and that I think anyone with any interest level would enjoy, I would say Shatner's Movie Memories book.
Oh yeah, that's a fantastic book. Yeah.
And the great thing about it is that is not just Shatner's point of view. In that book, as with Star Trek Memories, he interviews people who you know, worked on the productions and gets points of view from them that in some cases contradict his own, and then he, you know, integrates both of those into the text. So that's very interesting. The other one would simply be watch Nick Meyer's commentary on the Wrath of Khan.
I haven't done that yet.
Yeah, yeah. Or listen to, I should say, his commentary on the Wrath of Khan DVD.
I need to check that out.
So, yeah, to get a sense of what we're talking about. Same goes for motion picture. Again, Movie Memories, a lot of great information in that. Good commentary on the DVD. And I don't know if they carried over the extras from the DVD to the Blu-ray, but there's a featurette, I think, that the Okudas produced on the special edition DVD of Motion Picture, where it's phase two, and when they get into all that, and they show all the design sketches and kind of talk through what was planned for phase two, and how that kind of morphed into the motion picture and all that kind of stuff.
Oh, that's cool.
So do you want to talk about
the motion picture?
I was going to say, did you want to talk about the gap years between the TV series and the motion picture actually being released?
Well, we covered that briefly. That's really convoluted. We'll go over it a little bit for anybody that does not know, who's not a huge Star Trek fan or even a moderate Star Trek fan. After the series was canceled, of course, there was a letter writing campaign, and the fans were in uproar and wanted the series back on, and because what was the last episode? 69. So through the early 70s, and about, was it 75, they started working on scripts and stuff. Paramount was going to bring it back to television as Star Trek Phase 2 with pretty much the original cast.
With the notable exception of?
Of Nimoy.
Right.
And which kind of plays into the motion picture a little bit. The guy that was going to play the Vulcan, because they were going to have a Vulcan, ended up, wasn't he the one on Epsilon 9 at the beginning?
Yep.
Yeah, he was a human who got destroyed at the beginning.
No, he's a Vulcan in that.
He was the Vulcan? No, I thought he was the human guy that was on Epsilon 9 that gets destroyed.
No, well, he's on that satellite that gets destroyed, or whatever that thing was, the beginning that gets wiped out by the probe.
Whether it's human or Vulcan,
he had Vulcan ears on.
Could be. And they even did like some screen test footage, I think, with him, and they like the original uniform for Phase 2. But that went back and forth between, are they going to do a show? Are they going to do a movie? Are they going to do a show? Are they going to do a movie? Star Wars came out, and they're like, ooh, science fiction. Well, I don't know. We'll still do a show. And then Close Encounters came out, and it's like, oh, well, a science fiction that's not Star Wars can be popular in the theater. So they finally decided on to do the movie. And in between here was the first space shuttle got its maiden voyage, and it was originally named, I think, the Constitution. I believe that might be, I don't know, that might be off there. But there was a huge letter writing campaign yet again to President Ford at the time to petition him to change the name of the first space shuttle from Constitution to Enterprise. And they did. So the very first space shuttle, for those of you that don't know, and I'd be upset if anybody that does not know that. It should be common knowledge. The first space shuttle was called Enterprise.
We're upset with you right now.
Well, nobody knows history anymore, even recent history. I don't think they teach it in school. They got to have standardized tests. Okay, I'm not going to get off on that soapbox. But that's a real quick brief synopsis of what was going on between the series and the movie, and that is brief. Look it up, read it. There's a lot of other stuff going on in between there about how they flip-flopped between doing a series and doing the movie and all the people that were involved at different points as far as writers and possible directors and all. It's kind of interesting if you're a huge, you know, Star Trek fan and you don't know it already. Check it out. The information is out there.
It's out there.
So that's the name of that tune. Then the movie comes along, and that's where we're at now. Now, I remember going to see this in the theater when I was a kid. My parents took me, and the theater was packed. I mean, you know, we had to search for a seat, and it was like an event. I mean, Star Trek, you know, the show that everybody knew and everybody watched on TV. Now, after being off the air for so many years, it's a major motion picture and the original cast was coming back on the screen. And that, for my money, that is the coolest part about it, is seeing the characters for the first time in the movie that, you know, you haven't seen in so long. And then when they meet each other, you know, seeing the actors for the first time on the screen and then seeing the characters meet each other on film. That first shot of where that shuttle lands, well, okay, I'm sorry, let me back up. The first one you see is Spock on Vulcan, and he fails the Kolinar ritual, and then you don't see him again after that. Then you're back in, what, San Francisco at Starfleet headquarters, and that shuttle lands. And the camera pans up that window, and you see Kirk's face. And then the door opens. He's in that, you know, the cool Admiral's uniform, which is the only cool uniform in the whole movie. Okay, I'm going to soapbox a minute.
Here we go.
Oh, the worst thing about the movie to me are those god-awful pastel, soft mauve, whatever gray color, pajama uniforms. They don't look like a uniform. They don't like anything. They're boring and they're ugly, and it looks like they're all wearing loose-fitting pajamas. Whoever designed those and whoever said, okay, go with it, needs to be slapped upside the head. That's the worst thing about that movie to me. it's dead, drab, boring looking, the outfits. I mean, you go from the three bright colored shirts from the series, and then you go to these putrid, soft, ugly, drab colors. Thank God they changed Barathacon. So, okay, I'm off the soapbox now.
That's right. So I looked it up.
Oh.
And you are correct that the actor that was originally cast to play Zahn.
Zahn. I couldn't remember.
In Phase 2.
Yeah.
Is human on the Epsilon.
Oh, okay. Line, okay.
But they apparently created the character of Commander Sonak.
Ah, that's it.
Which is what he's thinking about.
The transporter accident.
Who gets in the transporter accident.
Who didn't live long, fortunately.
I kind of flipped those in my mind. Either that or because I know that you get a good close-up of the guy on Epsilon 9.
Yeah.
And I guess maybe in my mind, because I've known that was supposed to be Zahn for so long, I just project Vulcan ears on him, I guess. But in any event, what does it matter?
They get Vulcan ears for everybody.
The actor that was supposed to be the Vulcan in the series
got screwed.
Got a little bit part in motion picture.
That's here's really, a bone for you.
Really
you
what go. Goes on. So, yes, back to the uniforms. I don't know. I get it. Like, I would not try to make an argument for them, really. Because the motion picture is unique in all of Star Trek.
Yeah.
It's period in Star Trek, in the Star Trek timeline, or in Star Trek history, if you will, is largely unexplored. Its visual palette is unique to it.
Yeah.
I I just like everything about it, you know, including the uniforms, because, like, okay, would I have wanted those to be the Star Trek uniforms going forward from then, you know, through all the rest of the series? No, honestly, I wouldn't. As a matter of fact, I might be more critical of them if they had, but sort of the fact of their uniqueness makes them appealing to me. Maybe that's a nostalgia thing. I don't know.
Well, I get it. I get what you're saying.
Plus, I'm amused by their similarity to the Space 1999 uniforms.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the same cut, pretty much. I just, if they were different colors, I think it wouldn't bother me so much. It's just the all one color pants, tunic, and just the way they fit looks to me, it just looks like pajamas. Kirk's admiral uniform is cool as hell.
Yeah,
that looks sharp. Spock's Vulcan robes, those black robes when he gets on that looks pretty sharp, pretty regal, you know. Except for those football player security uniforms, those are the helmet and the chest protector thing. That's goofy, but other than that, so here we are at the beginning of the movie.
Well, let me break in a little bit here and say, well,
no, go ahead.
No, let me not. You go ahead.
Okay,
go ahead.
No, I was going to say, we get Kirk, we get that beauty establishing shot of Admiral Kirk, you know, coming in, and then we get a little expository dialogue where he talks to Commander Sonak about what's happening, what's going on, and you find out where Kirk has been in between the show and the movie. And, I mean, I love, you get his character right at the beginning, because I'm going to a meeting with Admiral so-and-so that should last no more than 2 minutes. In 3 minutes, I expect to be, you know? He's like, boom, but he's like quartermassing the guy, just telling him exactly what's going to happen and what he's going to do. And, you know, you establish the character. It's great, because you get Kirk right off the, you know, dick right out of gate again. And, you know, and then it just goes on after that. I mean, it's not a high-paced, fast action, but Kirk doesn't stop being Kirk. You know, he doesn't slow down.
Yeah.
His character and attitude just keeps going in every scene, and it's like he's constantly establishing himself as Kirk.
Yeah.
You know, which is cool. I like that. But you do get a little bit of the, I don't know if it's the age thing, but the refitted Enterprise, once he gets aboard and then he's like, doesn't know which way to go, and he asks somebody, you know, things have changed around. It's like, is he older or is it, you know?
No, it's a new ship.
Yeah.
That's a theme in the movie.
It's the old ship, but it's a new ship.
You don't know this Enterprise, Admiral, right? And can we just take a moment?
I know where you're going.
You do?
I think so. Go ahead.
I was going to say, can we just take a moment to point out how just trim and
oh, good, no.
and nice that Bill was looking for this movie.
Bill was looking sharp,
and those clingy, form fitting uniforms he was wearing.
He was working out.
Cutting a figure.
He was working out. You know, looking good, feeling good.
Here's to you, Bill. It wouldn't last.
No.
But
wait, he kept getting older.
He was rocking it.
That's right. The older you get, the less you care. You know, give me my check. I'll show up. You know. But
what did you think I was going to say?
Oh no, I thought you were something we've talked about many times. Is maybe the highlight of the movie that establishing shot of the Enterprise?
Yeah. Well,
you get that. It's like seeing an old friend, you know, and you see it on Kirk's face. You know, Shatner brings it home in that, and Scotty too, when they're in that pod and slowly coming up to the space dock.
Yeah,
and you get those little glimpses of it as they're going by, and he takes them all the way around, and you get that beauty shot of the whole thing. Yeah. And it's like, every time it's like, oh yeah, now we're starting the movie.
Yeah. Well, you know, so that's a dividing line, really. I mean, that might be the dividing line, which is kind of sad, because, you know, you might want to talk about like the ideas in it and, you know, things like that. But the dividing line oftentimes ends up being, you know, what is often referred to as the Enterprise flyby, which is what you were just talking about.
Yeah.
You know, which on one side of the line, you hear it goes on too long, it's boring. On the other side of the line, you hear it could be longer for all I care. It's awesome. You know, I suspect there's probably more people, sadly, on the former side than on the latter side I described, you know, on the it's long and boring side.
But, well, they don't get it.
You know, whatever sort of fondness or nostalgia you feel for the Enterprise, I mean, you can't take that out of the equation. And that's certainly a part of it for me. But really, that Jerry Goldsmith music.
Oh, man.
Married to, you know, gorgeous shots
uh-huh.
of a really beautifully designed object like yeah. the Enterprise. And
well, it's an iconic
the reverence and emotion in Shatner's eyes as we cut back to him, uh-huh. you know, just as cinema. I mean, for me, that could go on. And I'm not exaggerating. In movie time, especially when you're dealing with shots with no dialogue, 5 minutes is a long time.
Yeah.
It could be 5 minutes longer than it is today right now, and I would still be...
right there with him.
Yes, because come on, you know, just if you're taking it in as a sensory experience, again, that music,
yeah.
oh, come on, it's just, well, it's
and,
awesome.
And the meaning of what's going on at that moment. You got Kirk, who that was his home, that was his wife, you know, he was married to the ship, that was his ship.
Yeah.
He went life and death, you know, faced life and death on that ship and with that ship. For the original mission, 3 seasons, but for 5 years or more. And then he was on, teaching for however many years. And now he's getting her back. He's going back home is what's happening.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, really, he's going back home. He's been away at college or he's been away at whatever. And that's his lady. That's his home. And that's where all his friends are. His family is there.
It's sort of like this. It's like, look. If you watch those Peter Jackson Lord of the Rings / Hobbit movies, and you never ever get tired of long close-ups of crying Hobbit eyes or shots of the ring sort of tumbling in midair in slow motion,
yeah,
then you know what we're talking about here, right? You're there. You got it. You're with us, okay? But if you're sitting there going, for the love of Pete, can I please not see another pair of crying Hobbit eyes for as long as I live, when you're watching Return of the King, for example, then maybe you're on the other side of this
yeah. fence.
But still, I would say it's not the meaning of the scene and sort of your appreciation for what's going on with it. Those are important factors that you can't take out of it. But I would also add that, you know, it's just for me anyway, in my perspective, it's, you know, beautiful cinematic shots accompanied by gorgeous music.
Oh, I'm right there with you.
I could watch it all day long.
It's one of my favorite parts of the whole film.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and like I said, like we've talked about before in different things, that a lot of people just don't understand that they create, whether it's comic books, whether it's movies today, visual, you know, mediums, is iconic establishing symbols or shots. You got to have those things that stick with you like that, you know, or those iconic things that you look forward to, or like you said, or have meaning, you know, that establishes Kirk's character and part of who he is and his relationship to the ship and to the people on the ship in that shot going around with that score, with the look in his eyes and everything. You know, that's one, it's a great scene. It's one of my favorite in the whole movie. And then, have we gone on for that long enough? Or have we gone on longer than the scene?
I think that horse is dead.
And not that we're going to walk through the entire movie scene by scene, but then Kirk gets on the Enterprise. Mm. And when he first gets to the bridge, doesn't he like close his eyes right before the doors open?
Yeah.
Like, and takes a deep breath, and then the doors open, they all see him, and they, like, the original crew, his family, they stand up like they're amazed and happy to see him. And what does he do? Right into business. Dick out of the gate. He doesn't give hugs. He doesn't say, how you doing? He says, we've got a problem and we got to take care of it. And they're like, yes, sir. You know, and they go right into working mode. And then he's got to tell Decker. Let's face it. If Stephen Collins had been commanding that mission, they would have been just like the Klingons. They would have blasted that right in the beginning. It wouldn't have happened. he was no Enterprise commander.
No.
But yeah, and then, you know, and the movie starts and from there, and they go on the mission. And at first, you don't realize it. Wait, Spock's not there. Hold on. You know, because of everything else that's going on. And then when Spock shows up, you've got another.
We've checked in on Spock by this point, though.
We saw him at the very beginning, but then we didn't see him after that.
That he's, attempting to endure the ritual of Kolinar.
Yeah. And he was,
not to be confused with the fiery ritual of Carousel.
No. Which, hey, is it Phantasmo? No. We've already talked about that. But he was, you know, that was right at the beginning of the movie, and then we didn't see him. We get caught up in all this other cool stuff going on, and they're going on a mission, and you get introduced to Ilea, you know?
Right. Well, I just meant that, you know, since we know what's going on with Spock, and we know that Spock is in some way involved with what appears to be our plot with this probe thing going on.
Yeah.
That perhaps, that alleviates our...
Well, it could be our concern.
Where Spock could be. We know he's going to be there eventually.
Yeah. But all this other stuff going, you kind of won't think about it until that shuttle comes in and be like, oh, wait, that's probably Spock. this other iconic moment where he steps, you know, on the ship, and he's, because at the beginning he's got the long hair and all that, and he's got the Spock regulation Starfleet haircut, and looking regal in those robes, and Chekov's like, oh, Mr. Spock! And Spock goes dick right at it again. Yeah, just full on Vulcan, just like, screw you, Chekov, I'm here to do my job.
I will not acknowledge you because Kolinar.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But well, it's still...
You were saying about Ilea before?
Oh, yeah. You know, we get introduced to Ilea, new character, before we see Spock again. And, you know, hey, if you like bald chicks, psh, hey, all right.
If you like Persis Kambata and getting caught in the ring...
Oh, God, had to be said. Just be glad we didn't sing it.
If you like Persis Kambata...
Anyway, okay, we did.
Yeah.
But, who really isn't a bad-looking woman, you know, with a full head of hair?
No, well, dude, I think she's like a model or something. Yeah. I think Persis doesn't need
I'm
you.
I'm sorry.
I don't think Persis needs you to defend her beauty, sir.
Bald chicks don't do it for me. Sorry. It's just not my thing. Not here to judge. I'm just saying. But we find out that she and Decker had a little bit of a relationship before. Riker, Troy. But, you know, so that's established. And then Spock comes on. And everything's great again.
Well, we skipped a step.
Oh, we forgot. Yeah, we forgot that DeForest wasn't even on the ship. We don't have a doctor on the ship. Or not McCoy, but anyway. But yeah, then he beams on before they. That's before they get out of space dock, right?
Well, actually, we do have a doctor on the ship, right?
Well,
Dr. Chapel.
She's a doctor, yeah.
Yeah,
but yeah, and let's go back. We even got.
But Kirk requests McCoy.
Yeah.
Even though he's already got Dr. Chapel, the sexist bastard.
That's right. Sexism is alive and well in the 23rd century. But you know, he said,
Dr. Chapel,
go make me some soup.
You patronizing chauvinist piece of. Anyway, where are we? McCoy.
Well, before
up.
That, I was going to say they got everybody back. I mean, they got. Chapel, they got Yeoman Rand,
mm-hmm.
who was Ensign Rand, I guess, at this point, and even Mr. Kyle.
Moving slow up the ranks is Rand.
Mr. Kyle,
yeah.
The transporter chief, which reportedly...
Both of whom we'll see again before the series is over, by the way.
Yeah, reportedly they found him in like a flop house.
Aw.
Alcoholic. And the producers or whatever, or I forget who really wanted him back, but they wanted everybody they could get. And they found him, cleaned him up, you know, and gave him a job, got him in the movie, and they started doing conventions like everybody else.
Thanks, fandom.
Yeah. So McCoy gets on there, and you can't see DeForest for his tree, but
you
know.
You can't.
That was a god-awful outfit.
and his groovy beard and his swinging medallion.
I like he had like this mountain man beard, but his hair was still just that regulation Starfleet shortcut.
Yeah.
McCoy was a swinger.
He was a swinger.
You know, he sported the ascot in other movies, you know, just like Mr. Furley, you know, and Fred from Scooby-Doo. They're all swingers, you know.
Mr. Furley.
Look at D and Night Lepus. He's got an ascot, you know.
The D. Kelly, Don Knotts comedy duo. There's an idea whose time has come a little late, unfortunately, but I would have loved to have seen that.
It would have been awesome. But so now we got the whole crew reunited on the show.
Damn it, Furley.
And we're ready for the adventure.
because the human adventure
is just beginning. Yeah. You know, one thing that you see, though, that you only see, I think, in this one shot is when he's got everybody assembled on the Lido deck, or whatever they call it, and he's telling the entire crew, you know, what's going on, what the mission is. You see a lot of different alien races out there.
Yeah.
You know, as part of the crew, but then you don't see them anymore. It's like they did the makeup that one day. Let's get a shot while we can.
It's probably exactly what it was.
But yeah, you don't see him anymore after that, which is I think that's another missed opportunity.
Yeah.
That would have helped a little bit, is to see a little more variety on the screen as far as the alien, the people. Because they do kind of, they pan over him, you see, and you don't see him like lingering shots on him, I don't think. But yeah, missed opportunity. I think that would have been kind of cool. I don't know why they didn't. I don't know. What do you think, Tony?
Money?
Yeah. Like I said, we got that one day. Let's get it done.
We're paying a bunch of salaries already for these.
The principal's got a hefty fee to get them all back there because they were so busy doing other things at the time.
Hey, don't be mean.
Hey, Barbary Coast was done, man. In Search Of was done. I mean, you know. I don't know what the rest of them were doing. I mean, there's only so many episodes of Columbo you can do, you know.
Au contraire, sir.
Shatner did too. I saw Chekhov on one. But so anyway, so that brings us to right before we get to meet Nomad. I mean, V'ger. Didn't think I was going to bring that up,
yeah,
did you?
Well, yes, I did.
Okay. Okay, what I just did.
Let's watch this backwards. Let's watch this back again in slow motion.
Yeah.
Nomad.
Phyllis and I were watching some original series episodes not long ago, and the Changeling episode came on with Nomad, and, you know, partway into it, I was just all of a sudden, I was like, wait a minute.
you didn't realize that before?
Well, it's been so long since I'd seen it, I didn't think about it, you know. And I'd seen the movie a couple times since I've seen that episode. You know, when Star Trek, you see some episodes you see a lot,
yeah,
and some episodes you've only seen once or twice, maybe. And I think Nomad's one I've only seen once or twice a long time ago. And, it just hit me out of the blue. I was like, hey, wait a minute. This is kind of the same plot as the motion picture, sort of.
Yeah.
By the way, did you catch the name of the building where we were, the lounges in tonight?
I did.
Okay, good. I'll let that ride right there.
Yeah.
Though V'ger is much bigger than Nomad.
Well, it's on a much grander scale.
Yeah. Yeah.
Motion picture is all about scale.
Yeah.
And that's largely why it succeeds for me.
You know, I remember watching it the first time and getting the ending there of what V'ger was.
Yeah.
And going, oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
You know, it really is a cool plot, a cool story.
Yeah, which we have not and probably won't describe. We'll either assume that you already know or that you don't know, in which case we won't spoil the surprise. You just go ahead and watch the movie.
Yeah. Now, there's going to be one or two people going, God damn it!
Yeah. But what he's alluding to with the Star Trek episode, the season 2 original series episode, The Changeling, has a lot in common with the plot of the motion picture.
A little bit, a little bit.
Yeah.
A little bit. So that's where we are. Jump right in anytime.
Okay. So.
I'm just rambling until you start talking.
He's a rambling man.
I'm a rambling guy.
So the experience of seeing Star Trek the Motion Picture in the theater as a 6-year-old was something, because that's what I was in 1979.
I was 10.
Something akin for me. Well, I remember it. I mean, my memory is a little holy.
Yeah.
By which I do not mean sacred.
Oh, hell no.
From being that age. But I do remember sitting there in that theater feeling things that I can now describe as something like awe.
Oh, yeah.
And a little, like, fear.
Uh-huh.
A little, like, fear. Not that I was afraid, but that the sensory experience of that movie for me, and by that I mean, you know, the audio visual, you know, the music and the sound effects.
Yeah.
And the visual element of it was overwhelming to the extent, you know, sort of spine tingling and exciting to the extent that it was almost scary for me as a kid. I remember that experience very well. And any time I would see the movie for years thereafter, it would usually be, you know, you'd catch it wherever it was in progress on HBO or whatever. And as a kid, I just remember I would, wherever it was in the movie, no matter what, if it was on and I caught it, I would just sit and watch it in this sort of rapt silence or whatever. And I don't know how long it took before and how many viewings it took for me to actually understand the plot, you know? For me, it was always just a sensory experience. I imagine the experience that I had with this movie was something akin to... And remember, I'm six, okay? So relative scale here, okay? But the experience that folks describe of seeing 2001 A Space Odyssey in the theater in, you know, 69, is that when that was released?
Somewhere around there.
Yeah, 69, I think. Just that sort of, you know, overwhelming, again, sensory experience, that feeling of awe and wonder that a lot of people describe having seen 2001 for the first time in the theater. As adults, you know, in my little six-year-old head, something like that was going on with motion picture. And I will say that is definitely why it is and has always been special to me. Looking back on it, I watch it very fondly now. Now, you know, I don't necessarily get the goosebumps anymore, you know, but I can appreciate, what it's trying to do, the scale on which it's trying to do it, the fact that it is, unique in both the Star Trek, I hate this word, but franchise and, the kind of thing you're very unlikely to see anymore, you know? So it's just sort of like this little singular jewel for me, you know. Now, does that mean I cannot see the ways in which it is not successful and the ways in which it doesn't quite succeed in what it sets out to do? You know, it really wants to be about, you know, the experience of being human and what does it mean to be human. Does it have a clear point to make, or does it succeed, I think, in sort of stirring that process of thought in the average viewer? I don't know. You know, I don't know. But I admire it for the attempt. You know, I mean, clearly Robert Wise and at least some of the other folks working on the film, but definitely Wise, was heavily inspired by 2001. I think that's a matter of record. I think you said as much. And that shows itself in a lot of different places, including some of the design elements, like the uniforms, which you don't like. It's amusing to me that Star Trek The Motion... I'm just rambling, by the way. So if I'm failing to make points along the way, sorry, folks. But here we go. So it's amusing to me that it seems to have a lot in common aesthetically and thematically with Space 1999.
Yeah.
Now, there's two ways to look at that. One, that the motion picture could have been directly influenced by Space 1999. And the other would be that they are both heavily influenced by 2001 A Space Odyssey.
Oh,
and what you're seeing is two, you know, separate and distinct entities that were not influences on one another, but that both have a common ancestor, you know. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I could see that,
I'm not sure what the truth of that is. I think by the time you get to the motion picture, I'm sorry, by the time you get to the Next Generation, that's what I meant to say.
Yeah.
By the time you get to the Next Generation, which in many ways is modeled on the motion picture, or at least is in many ways modeled on discarded ideas for phase two that also showed up in the, or otherwise discarded ideas for phase two that that also showed up in the motion picture. By the time you get there, it's undeniable that folks behind the scenes are quite aware of Space 1999 and have been influenced by it. So you can build a case from there that that might have also been true when the motion picture got made. The reason why that's ironic, of course, is that Star Trek fans were, you know, very vocally opposed to 99 in a lot of ways, and highly critical of it.
Yeah, I need to go back and watch some Space 99.
And not just the fans. I mean, you know, no less a personage than someone like Asimov had all kinds of unfortunate and unpleasant things to say.
Wow.
Well, you know, 99 has some pretty way out, shall we say, science in it. But, you know, it aspires to instilling in us a sense of awe and wonder in the mysteries of the universe.
Okay.
You could, if I want to dress that up pretentiously, I could say its ambitions are a little higher than plausible science. But I don't really like the way that sounds at all, so I'll retract that. But anyhow, the motion picture again is clearly concerned with the same sort of thing, right?
Yeah.
Awe and mystery and wonder of the universe. And your mileage may vary on how successful it is, but I adore it for even attempting such a thing. And then because it is so accomplished cinematically, again, visually, as directed by Robert Wise, and sonically with the beautiful music of Jerry Goldsmith.
Oh, well, yeah, the music was incredible, yeah.
It works pretty damn well for me.
Yeah, yeah.
Was there anything in that ramble that
made
sense?
No, I was with you. Okay, I was with you the whole time.
Okay.
I was paying attention. I was just happy to see him get the band back together. Yeah. I mean, I don't know, honestly, for me, you know, that was the biggest thing of it, is seeing these characters that have this long relationship getting back together and getting the job done and falling right into what they used to do effortlessly as characters, not the actors. You know, the respect between the characters and Kirk. And, you know,
well, see, but the critics, particularly in the fandom, the folks who don't like the movie or don't hold it in as high a regard as some of the others, perhaps I should say, argue that it doesn't handle that element of it. And I agree with you, by the way.
Yeah.
But they would argue that it doesn't handle that element of it well enough.
Well, it doesn't address it
directly.
Yeah, it doesn't address it directly, but like I said earlier, when Kirk steps on the bridge and you see the look on the faces of his crew, not the new people, but his crew, the principals,
right?
You know that they are thrilled to see him again.
Yeah.
And like, everything's going to be okay, or we're going on a mission. I mean, you know, the look on their faces is like, man, and Kirk immediately just goes into captain mode.
Yeah.
And they like, yes, sir.
And you could build a very strong case that that approach is truer to what the television series actually was than what they would do with it later. Now, what they do with it later in making it more focused on, you know, those more focused on those relationships in an Otra sort of way, you know. I like that. I enjoy it. That's not a criticism in any way, but you could say that we're thrilled to see you, sir, and you know we're all happy to be together again, but we're professionals and we have a mission, and that's what takes precedence here.
Yeah.
And we don't necessarily have to have a conversation about how we're professionals and need to, you know what I mean? Let that take precedent to get that across. You can say that that is truer to the spirit of the show, I think. You can build a case for that.
Well, and two, it doesn't need to be spoon-fed to the audience. Yeah. If you get it, you get it. And also, that's not the time for that.
Yeah,
for that to happen. The movies go on later, and those scenes take place where you get more character relationships, stuff going on. There's no direct threat happening at that moment, so they can have those conversations and stuff. Whereas right now, they've got X amount of hours; they got to get going.
Yeah,
so they can't take time to have a reunion and to be all, you know, pat each other on the back, and it's good to see you. But like you said, the look is, we're here for you, we're glad to see you, we know we got to get a job done, we're professionals, let's go, sir.
Yeah.
you know, and to those moments like that in movies, you know, in anything, especially in this one, to me are some of the greatest things.
Well, they're worth
when
more.
When a look can get across what two pages of dialogue.
They're worth more for being relatively quiet moments. Relatively, I should say, you know, quiet moments.
I think it speaks volume of the actors, too, to be able to convey that. You know enough about the history of the characters that you know all that anyway. Yeah. But even if you didn't, you know there's something going on there.
Right.
You know that, oh, they know each other and they'll do anything that guy says.
Yeah.
You know.
But, you know, character-wise, what the movie is really concerned with is Kirk's lust to get in that ship and get back out there.
Yeah.
You know, and how that might affect his judgment and how far he's willing to go to do that. And of course, you know, Kirk or Spock's, you know, is he going to finally reject his human half with Kolinar?
Yeah.
You know, or is he going to go the way he eventually goes, particularly on the director's cut, having experienced the mind meld with V'ger and all that. So, you know, those are, and then of course to a lesser extent, but poignantly as far as the themes of the movies are concerned about the Decker and Aaliyah relationship.
Yeah.
You know, those are the things that it's primarily concerned with character wise. And we don't expend long pages of dialogue about those things either. But you know, I think that's, again, perfectly okay. Now, there are some, I think, that feel that the Kirk's, again, lust to get in that ship and get out there again, and his, hesitate to call it ruthlessness, but for sake of something to call it, let's call it that. In doing so, I think there's those who feel that maybe that's not true to the character that they knew from television. But you know, you're talking about a character in on the television series. You're talking about a character in his natural element doing the thing he loves to do that he was, you know, feels he was born to do, versus a character who has not been able to do that now for years and has gotten older and is sick and tired of being at a desk.
They address that in Generations.
Never let them take you off the bridge of that ship.
Yeah. While you're on that bridge, in that chair, you can make a difference.
Yeah.
And, you know, Kirk lays it out right there. That's the whole thing. That's why he was trying to get back. You know, he felt even though he was teaching, you know, he wasn't making a difference in anything. You know, anybody could get up there and teach rules and regulations and tactics and techniques and stuff. But on that bridge, in that chair, he can do, like you said, what he was meant to do and do what only he can do and make a difference. And he knew it. And, you know, I mean, that's why he wanted to get back there.
And ultimately, I think Kirk is a better character for being a little bit of an egotist. Just a little bit.
Well, it's part of his makeup.
Something I've often argued is that
but it's so slight compared to the way it's handled in other characters and other movies, that type of personality trait.
It is. How slight it is, I guess, is arguable. But what I meant by being a better character for being a bit of an egotist is there seems to be, I perceive a message in the original series that says that we as human beings, we know that we're flawed. We know that, you know, we come from these primitive origins and have done some really stupid things in the past. And we know we've got a long way to go before we achieve all that we aspire to achieve. But we are better for the journey, for understanding that we can be better, for, you know, reaching towards something greater. Ethically, philosophically, scientifically. Yeah,
learning as we go.
We are better for the attempt to perfect ourselves.
Yeah.
By contrast, there's something in Next Generation that says to me, we have now perfected ourselves and we're going to flit about the universe, lording it over everybody else, you know?
Yeah.
And that's a gross oversimplification. Don't take that to mean that I don't like the Next Generation, because I actually do. But there's some, you got to admit there's some truth to that.
No, I get that totally. Get that.
Yeah.
And I think that's what kind of bugged me about it from the get go, and why I, you know, when it first came on, I watched the first couple episodes and I didn't watch it again until second or third season. I got back into it. It just didn't, when it first came on, there was something about it I couldn't put my finger on that just didn't work for me about the whole attitude of the show or the universe. And I warmed up to it, but, you know, second or third season, I got back into it and enjoyed it for what it was, but it didn't have that, like you said, you know, about the original series, the learning as we go, you know, being the journey and not being perfect. And Next Generation, everything's perfect.
Yeah.
But back to the motion picture, because that's what we're supposed to be talking about.
We're talking about.
And we are talking about. We're relating everything back to it.
Yeah.
Man, where are we in the movie?
Well, I think the only piece of Star Trek that you can discuss in a vacuum, like you can just sort of talk about it and only it, is the original series. Once you get past the original series, I feel like it all is sort of connected and it all becomes, you know, relative to the other pieces of the Star Trek universe. But,
you know, what I really want to know, I want to know what was going on between the first movie and the second movie. Story-wise, with the characters, with Starfleet and all that. Because there is such a drastic change in design.
Oh, first movie and the second movie. Some reason I thought you said the series. And
No.
I was going to say, well, you got a couple years to go on that mission for one thing.
No, between the first movie and the second movie. Because there's a drastic change in design in the uniforms.
Yeah.
But also, the characters are established back in those positions again. Spock is in Starfleet.
Yeah.
And he's not as distant as he is in the first movie. You know?
Well, I mean, again, you can conclude that is Spock's trajectory from what happens in the motion picture, particularly, again, in the director's cut. I think that's true.
Yeah.
So,
but I mean, I think it would be interesting to see what those years between those two.
Yeah.
What happened.
Yeah, well, the only place you're going to find that is in novels. I don't think there's that many novels set in that time period. And of the ones that I've read, I haven't liked them very much, unfortunately. So,
I saw Spock's, was it Spock's World? Was that one of the novels?
Yes, but that...
he's wearing, on the cover, he's wearing the motion picture uniform.
Yeah, but I don't know.
I saw that at Thrift Store the other day. Just throwing that in there. Human
interest. I've read that one. I don't remember it super well, but I think that's one that sort of moves around between two or three different timelines. It's not just set in.
Hey, here's one for you. I don't know if they're going to do it or not. I'll have to ask.
Time periods, I should say.
Clayton, again, since he's got nominated for his performance in Phase 2, the fan series online.
Nominated by what?
I forget the title, but he played Kor, the Klingon.
Yeah, but what was he nominated for?
Some fan award. But anyway...
I'm sure it's a very prestigious fan award.
Hey, honestly,
and I'm sure Clayton is honored to have been nominated, Rob.
I'll tell you, though, I did watch the episode, and it was good. It was a good episode. It was done very well, and he was good in the part. Not that I was surprised, but it was good. I mean, it really was. It's Star Trek Phase 2 fan series is... It's beautifully shot. It looks great. Everything about it looks good. The people playing the characters doing a good job of who they're supposed to be, without doing a caricature of the actors. And Clayton playing Kor was fun. He did a great job. Being imposing, being as tall as I am, and the other Klingons were a foot taller. He made it work, you know. But getting into that, though, one thing I'd heard, and like I said, I might have to ask him to see if this is so or if I'm just got it mixed up in my head, but, you know, they were doing that online show. They were doing Star Trek, was it Next Voyages or Continuing Voyages, where they were doing the next 2 years that weren't shown on TV of the original Voyage. And then when they stopped doing that, now they're doing Star Trek Phase 2, which is the next series of missions after the original series. I don't know if this was they were thinking about doing this or they are going to do this. I can't remember. After they wrap up Phase 2, they're going to go into the motion picture years. Or they were talking about doing it, or they are going to do it. I can't remember. But it'd be something interesting to check out. And if they do it, that'd be kind of neat to see.
I can only say, be careful who you put in those uniforms, folks. That's all I'm going to say. That's all I'm going to say.
They're not flattering. yeah. But that's kind of, you know, that would be kind of interesting.
Well, have you, I know you haven't. I won't pretend like I haven't asked you this question before. You have not yet watched, I believe it's Star Trek Continues, the other
I want to see some of that.
I watched, I liked that one quite a bit. I liked it quite a bit. So
I'll have to check that out. Because like I said, the thing about it, one of the things that struck me about this one is even the lighting looks like the lighting on the original series. You know, it's incredible.
Well, they do a good job with that on Star Trek Continues as well.
I mean, I'll check out any fan production, you know, especially one that comes recommended.
Good on all y'all is what we're saying here.
Yeah. Keeping the dream alive, yo. Yeah. Yo.
Yeah. But, yeah, they do a good job. I really like the guy that plays Vic Mignogna, the guy that plays, who I guess is the head of the project, but he plays Kirk in it. Of course, because if you're the head of that project, what part are you going to play? Particularly if you're a
Ensign Kyle.
Particularly if you're a pro actor, right? but he does a good job, I think, playing Kirk the way that Shatner played Kirk in the 60s without playing a caricature of Shatner, which is a difficult thing, I think, to do.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
At least from what I have seen and what I suppose, that's a difficult thing to do. But there's no doubt that he's playing Kirk again the way that Kirk was played in that time, but it doesn't feel like he's I'm being Shatner or whatever. Yeah. There's a fine line there and he manages to walk it very well, and that's one of the things that makes that series work well. That and the fact that the sets and the lighting are all very authentic and whatnot.
Cool.
So yeah.
That's cool. Yeah.
And the stories are very much, I think, in the spirit of the original series.
Yeah. Right on.
Anyway, huge tangent there. Motion picture.
Back to the motion picture.
Where are we? We are 1 hour and 16 minutes into this recording.
All right. Well, we'll be done pretty soon.
And if I manage to live up to my ambition of not having to do any editing on this episode whatsoever, it might actually be 1 hour and 16 minutes.
There were very few to the ums and ahs and pauses.
That. Yeah, I know.
And there's another
And it's staying in.
And the pauses, think of them as dramatic pauses.
They are.
Not grasping for the next thing to say.
Yeah.
Just to put out there, merchandising that came out when the movie came out.
Tons.
Tons of it. There was a little metal Urdle Enterprise that I had. I had the phasers, which were precursors to laser tag, but they were the Star Trek motion picture phasers, which I think I ended up giving to Clayton or trading to Clayton at one point. I wonder if he still has them. Do you? I didn't like the design of them, though.
Well, we should say one thing we didn't talk about. I hate to interrupt you, but fits with what you're saying.
Yeah.
Is so the motion picture happened in the wake of Star Wars.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, that's, I think, a big part of the reason why it got turned into a movie and not a series. Isn't that right? Why they ended
one
up
of the
just,
things.
One of the things that finally made them decide.
That, well, Star Wars was such a big deal. And then it was like on again, off again. And then something I read recently said that when Close Encounters came out, and showed that a science fiction movie could be a huge hit that wasn't Star Wars, that's when they went back to going, let's do the movie now.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Shatner might even write about that in the book. It's been years, maybe 10 years since I've read Movie
Memories.
Yeah, me
too.
But again, I do recommend the book. But the point is, and this is more or less common knowledge, but in case you weren't there, Star Wars kicked off a huge boom that ran, from 77 through early middle 80s, I would say, in sci-fi fantasy special effects movies.
Oh, yeah.
So, and sci-fi fantasy special effects movies, that were accompanied by merchandising onslaughts. See, I'm tying it back to what you were saying, because of course, Lucas was something of a visionary when it came to movie merchandising.
Oh yeah, of course.
And
I mean, there was a little bit.
That's how he
that.
Made his personal fortune.
You know, one of the first movies or movie series to really do succeed in the merchandising blitz.
Planet of the Apes.
Yep, it was.
Yeah.
Which I want to say, I was going to say is surprising, but it's not really surprising because those movies were big when they came out. And there was a ton of merchandise for that. Yeah. And it took off like a shot.
Yeah, so maybe visionary isn't the right word. Maybe Lucas would, because you're right, and I had kind of forgotten that was something that had been running through the 70s.
Yeah, but
it had
phased out towards the end of the 70s when Star Wars was coming.
Yeah, but he just read the wind pretty well, let's say that, and understood that he could make a lot of money off of toys and bubblegum cards and God knows what else all.
And he did. Yeah. I mean, that's where he made it. He didn't make his money on the movie. Yeah. He made his money on the merchandising. Yeah. And the money from the merchandising financed the next two movies.
Yeah. So, I mean, between the time I was... So, in 77, I'm 4 years old.
Yeah.
In 83, I'm 10. Okay. So, between, you know, 4 and 83, the significance of 83 being Return of the Jedi.
Yeah.
Okay.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And even though... there were all kinds of sci-fi fantasy movies that were made throughout the 80s after that.
Yeah.
I would say the heyday is probably, you know, 77 to 85. Wouldn't you say that's probably true?
You start
getting a lot more low budget.
Yeah, I would
less
say
ambitious
so.
Stuff
yeah,
after
Yeah, I would say so as
Aliens,
far as
you
new
know.
Stuff
yeah.
coming out and not sequels.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would be it. Yeah.
Yeah, so anyway, in that late 70s, early 80s period, you get Star Wars and Empire, you get Star Trek the Motion Picture, you get The Black Hole, you get Clash of the Titans, you get Blade Runner, you get
Alien?
Wrath of Khan, you get Alien, exactly, and Superman the movie.
Oh yeah, I was thinking about that earlier. I meant to bring that up.
And then, you know, when cable and eventually the VCR really take hold, you begin to be able to or if you were just located in such a place where you could take advantage of this stuff when it was happening theatrically, which was not true everywhere, you begin to get into the world of all the knockoffs that were happening, the lower budget movies that were
Battle
sort of
Beyond
that
the
were
Stars.
Riding that same wave.
Star Crash, God help us all.
Right. So there's just this plethora of that kind of material that was going on in those years, and a lot of it, particularly the higher profile, bigger budget stuff, had toy campaigns and merchandising campaigns, and Star Trek Motion Picture was definitely one of those higher profile projects that had lots and lots of merchandise.
The first one that I can remember tied in McDonald's Happy Meals was Star Trek the Motion Picture. And I went and got as many as those. I wish I still had them now. Those Happy Meal boxes with the little Star Trek toys in them. I'm trying to think what other standout merchandise.
So you had the 12-inch dolls.
No, I didn't. Well, they came out.
They existed.
I never had them. Yeah.
So here you have is the way in which I meant that. You know, there were a series of 12-inch dolls.
And the odd thing about them is the faces over time, like turned green or
brown. And gray. Yeah,
weird.
Yeah. And you had requisite 3 3/4-inch figures.
Yeah.
Which was a first for Star Trek at that point.
I might still have Scotty from that.
Yeah.
And
you got to figure those were especially easy to sculpt given the uniforms and the limited scope of the figures, you know.
Put a different hint on that one.
And I guess wasn't there was a bridge set that went with those?
I think there was, but I never saw one. I mean, I don't remember seeing one in person, but I'm sure there was.
Oh, I never had it, but I'm pretty sure there was.
There was. And there was different, of course, they had the, you know, different size Enterprise, metal and plastic ships and a Klingon bird of prey.
And somebody had the drinking glasses, right? Those existed. And
I don't know. You know what? I don't think so.
They definitely exist for some of the later Star Trek movies.
They had them for Khan.
Yeah.
Or, no, Star Trek 3.
Star Trek 3, they definitely... I know they had them for Burger King Star Trek 3. Glasses,
yeah. Right? I'm not sure about Khan. I don't think they had them for Motion Picture.
Okay, well, maybe not. So maybe when I say lots and lots, maybe on a relative scale that's to what was going on at the time, that's not quite true. But, you know, it was still a significant amount of stuff they
I mean, you had your basic stuff. You had different action figures. You had your ships.
Yeah.
You had the phasers. You know,
coloring books, magazines.
Coloring books, magazines all over the place.
Book and record sets.
Halloween costumes. Yeah. Which brings us to the Shatner mask, which came out for Motion Picture, I believe. Yes, it did, because you had Shatner, Nimoy, and the bald Klingon, which could have been Nosferatu.
Okay.
Those three masks came out for Motion Picture, and the Shatner mask, everybody knows this, and if you don't hear for the first time, the Shatner mask from Motion Picture is the mask they use for Michael Myers. They bleached the hair out or lightened the hair and painted it white. And that's Michael Myers. And any other mask they use in any of the Halloweens that isn't that mask is god-awful looking. So Shat lives on.
Shat lives on forever.
But
Shatner is everywhere.
He is everywhere, man. He is. And he is, though. Just recently celebrating his, was it 82nd birthday or 88th birthday? I can't remember. He had a birthday like a couple days ago.
Yeah.
Oh, Captain, my Captain.
Mm-hmm.
But in wrapping this up, I guess, Star Trek The Motion Picture, or we could go on for another hour if you want.
Well, so I don't know. I mean,
I talk about
the motion picture being as cinema. I think it's probably, for me, it's better than any other Star Trek movie made.
It's better on a big screen than on a small TV.
Yeah,
because it is a cinematic movie. The shots are made to be seen. Big.
And I almost wish I had gone through it sort of shot by shot and taken notes so that I could articulate it a little better what I mean by that in the podcast. And
they'll have to watch it now.
Maybe I'll do that someday and post a few examples on the Facebook.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, I say that, I say it in a way that's unqualified. You know, your mileage may vary, but what I can speak to with the utmost sincerity and clarity is that for me, having been a kid in that era I was describing, that, you know, 77 to 85, in which I would have been 12. So, I mean, that's almost exactly, I'm positioned almost exactly right to be hit by that stuff that was going on in pop culture with the maximum impact. You know, I saw all that stuff. Okay. And every single one of them, Black Hole and Superman and all of it in the theater. And enjoyed it all and remember most of it, at least vaguely, and have a fondness for it, of course. But just the experience, the audiovisual experience, the emotional experience of the motion picture at that time for me was unique, like nothing else.
Yeah.
It will always be special for that reason. It sets and carries a mood that if you are willing to sort of ride along with it, is very cool. If you go through it with a checklist of things you're expecting to find in a Star Trek movie, you may very well be disappointed. But if you just take in the sight and the sound of it, which is really what I mean when I say as cinema, of course, it's got something very cool to offer.
And two, you have to watch it, and you have to put yourself in the mindset that this is the first time, you know, these actors, these characters are back on the screen.
Yeah.
And first time in a long time. And, you know, you haven't seen the other Star Trek movies yet, so there's nothing to compare it to. But the big thrust of it is this is the first time these folks have gotten back together in a long time, and they have a problem to solve. They have a mission to go on to save the Earth. And with in that mindset, you know, if you can put yourself in that mindset watching it, I think you'll enjoy it more than people what you remember seeing it in the past, if you haven't seen it in a long time, and have the other ones like Wrath of Khan and Search for Spock in your head that are more action oriented. Because like you said, you know, the cinematic scope of it is one thing, and you have to sit back, watch it, and on a, I would say, like I said earlier, on a big screen to take it all in. It doesn't play as well, that aspect of it, on a small TV, which, and before big screens came in just a few years ago, that's, you know, TVs were only so big unless you had one of those big projector ones. So I can almost see how people over the years watching it on TV may not have thought as much of it as the other films.
Pan and scan does it no favors, I would concur.
Oh, yeah, but exactly. And then if you had it in widescreen, even on widescreen, you're on a small TV.
Yeah.
So being able to enjoy it on Blu-ray on a big screen, you know, big flat screen TV like we have nowadays, really is a different experience than you've watched it before.
Yeah.
And taking that into account, what you were saying about the cinematic aspects of it and the beauty of all that, and the music just is, the Goldsmith score is incredible. And then the whole thing about this is the first time.
Yeah.
This is the beginning of everything that's going to come later. You know, I think you might enjoy it if you haven't seen it again. I know I did when I watched it not long ago, and I kind of want to watch it again. After we've been talking about it here, I would really like to sit down and watch it again. And, you know, I can get that sense of awe and that sense of wonder. I can relive that from put it back in my head from the first time I've seen on just about anything. If it's something I really enjoy,
yeah,
you know, or the first time I played an album, I can get in that mindset when I listen to something or when I watch a movie or even read a book or a comic. And I'm glad. I'm really glad I can do that and really enjoy these things to the fullest, like the first time. And that's kind of how you have to approach this, I think, you know, to really, really enjoy it. And please do. Go back and watch this movie and see if it changes your opinion. If you had, opinion that it was the worst of the films or you didn't care for it that much. But go watch it again and see if it works better for you.
Yeah. Well, you know, I realized, and you touched on it again a little bit just a minute ago.
Yeah.
I said, yeah, I almost wish I had went through it shot by shot and written down some time code so I could talk about some unnecessary. Because I think you pointed to a couple things that really illuminate it already.
Yeah.
You know, I say, you know, as cinema, because I like the way that sounds. It's very hoity-toity and special sounding, right? But what we're really saying when we say that is telling stories and or evoking emotions with moving pictures and also with sound and music.
Yeah.
That's all we're talking about.
Yeah.
Specifically with moving pictures and accompanying sound and music, as opposed to, you know, dialogue and the drama that is evoked through dialogue. It's the drama inherent in the moving picture, right? So when we talk about how the characters, just to name one example, can communicate with a look.
Yeah.
A look to one another or a look to the Enterprise or whatever the case may be, all that we really need to know about what they're feeling in that moment in their life. What we're talking about is cinematic, you know, and so even the character element of it that some folks come away from this movie hungry for because they don't feel like that it addressed it. Even that, I think, is
they weren't watching the movie.
No, well, even that was addressed cinematically.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. So, and you know, and real quick, you know, on that, I think it's something I've said many times before. The actors in the movie, Shatner in particular, but all of them get a lot of flack for not being very good actors because they just did Star Trek.
I couldn't possibly disagree with that more. But
yeah, I'm the same way. Yeah. But it's those moments like that that make them incredible actors, because those little moments, and throughout the original series, throughout the films, and those couple of moments in this film, it's common knowledge that these during the course of the original series, a lot of the actors, they didn't care for each other, or they didn't care for Shatner, and Shatner didn't care for them. Okay, the lead of the show, the captain, they didn't care for him as a person. Now, when it came time to work and they yelled, action, cameras are rolling, you believed these characters had a relationship. You believed they would jump in front of a, you know, a car for each other. And you believed that Sulu, Uhura, Scotty, McCoy, Spock, Chekhov, they would do anything that Kirk said. You know, they would follow him to the ends of the universe because they respected the captain.
Yeah.
They respected Jim Kirk as a person. He knew he could count on each one of them to do their jobs and knew they were going to do it. He didn't have to think about it. You know, you got that from the character relationships. And that's damn good acting because none of that is spoon-fed to you. They never say it. You know, they never come out and say any of that. But you get that from the way they react and act towards each other. That's damn good acting. You know, I'll say it over and over and over and over and over again. There's a lot of huge, big, very good actors that you don't get that from in movies they're in with other people. You know, you don't get that. And nothing I can point out off the top of my head because it didn't leave an impression.
Yeah.
But those little things, you're like, man. You know, you get it. And it's amazing.
Well, here at the 90-minute mark, we should probably go ahead and wrap up. And as I say that, I can't help but think of all the things that we didn't cover. Well, for example, we didn't really talk about Robert Wise, the director. I mean, we talked about how, you know, this movie is more accomplished cinematically,
yeah,
and written on a grander scale, or produced on a grander scale, yeah, let's say, you know, cinematically than the others. And one reason for that is because it had a strong, established, experienced director in Robert Wise. So we didn't talk about him and all the things that he's done, and we didn't talk about Roddenberry much and how much Roddenberry is or isn't in this movie as it relates to all kinds of things. But
we can do another episode at some point and give an overview of the films, the original crew films, and compare and contrast and talk about the directors and not so much the story of each film, but the directors of the films, compare and contrast between them and what's a success about the films and what's not.
Yeah, let's do that.
That might be interesting.
We should do that.
Okay, we'll do that for a future episode.
That's right.
The next episode coming up after this one, God knows when that'll be, we'll put that out soon on the Phantasmo After Dark Facebook page. All the information will be there on the episode after this, which may or may not be about John Carpenter's Assault on Precinct 13.
Dun, dun, dun.
If it's not this next one, it'll be coming up. But that's what we're shooting for, folks. Hey, drop us a line on the Facebook page or what's the Phantasmo email again?
Phantasmopod@gmail.com.
Yeah, let us know whether you like it, you hate it, you want to hear something different, or you want us to shut up, or, you know, whatever. And on the Facebook page also, Phantasmo After Dark. And join us, won't you?
Good night.
Good night.